Good afternoon.
Let's have
more volume. Okay. So last time we were talking about our single cycle processor design, and we started introducing the stages our textbook talks about, and I emphasized that these are, at this point, just conceptual stages. They're ways of dividing up the work of designing our processor, but our hardware components, they either act all the time for doing computations or reading values from memory or the register file, or only actually do something when triggered by the rising edge of a clock signal, which is going to happen once per instruction in this design. So we do all the reading and computation work after the rising edge of the previous instruction's clock cycle, and when the next rising edge comes, then we actually store the results of the current instruction. And we started looking at sort of the wiring that corresponds to each of the stages the textbook talks about and the names the textbook uses. And we just got to our decode, as you mentioned, is not where we actually like interpret the instruction so much as where we read the registers for an instruction. So in our decode step, the most straightforward thing to do would be you say, oh, we have two register numbers in instruction at most. We just put those up to the source register numbers in the register file, and it's going to output those two register values for us. But this didn't always quite work. There's some of these instructions it doesn't work for. And the way I would figure this out, and sort of the process I have, is I just list all the instructions, say, what do I want to use for each of these instructions? What do I want to set that register number to? And for some of the instructions, we don't really care about having anything in there. For a couple of them, we need somewhere to read the stack pointer. So it better be one of those two. I just chose arbitrarily that it would be the second input. And this tells us that, hey, we're going to need a mux for all these possibilities. And those are the inputs going to be. And we're going to have some logic function that looks at what instruction it is, which we know happens from the iCode. And technically, you know, we need to add this hardwired RSP because we can't get that elsewhere. And the straightforward thing to do would be the input none when we're not reading anything, but we really don't care if not happens to read some registers as long as we don't do anything with those values. So that gives us sort of the logic we need for the decode step, where we need this extra mux, which we're going to control based on the instruction code that lets us pass the stack pointer for the stack manipulation instructions, which need to read the stack pointer, because how else do they know where to write to in memory or read from in memory? So any questions on what we have so far on our picture here? So the next step the textbook talks about is what they call execute. And execute is where the thing that you think of as the computation in an instruction happens. So most straightforwardly, this is for the add instruction actually adding, for the subtract instruction actually subtracting, and so on. But even instructions which don't do computation as their main goal sometimes have computation to do. The most notable example is sometimes we need to compute an address. We need to do some addition to get an address or some subtraction, and that means we're going to have an ALU operation doing that, because that's the hardware we have that can easily do that. So that's what we're going to do, for example, for MR move Q. We're going to actually compute the addition of the register value and the displacement. This is also where our textbook deals with condition codes. So condition codes are set based on the result of arithmetic operations. So those arithmetic operations all happen in the execute part of the processor. So that's the part where we're going to worry about how do we set the condition codes. And this is also where the textbook authors chose to deal with reading the condition codes. So there's some instructions which need to do this, namely the conditional jump instructions and the conditional move instructions. So our textbook kind of thinks of the condition codes as some sort of like built-in functionality that would be provided for you. That's not how we're going to do it. You're going to have to build that yourself from simpler components. But what using the condition codes essentially is going to look like is that somewhere, and this is, we're going to take the thing that says whether we're doing a less than, greater than, and so on, and we're going to look at the condition codes and compute the appropriate thing. So if it's zero, that means it's an unconditional jump, for example. We want to always do something. If it's less than or equal, we check whether the thing that was computed that said the condition codes was negative or zero, and so on. And so we can use a mux to decide between all of these options. And then we, for example, can use that to decide for a conditional move what register number we pass to the register file. We can use that as part of what we pass to the mux in front of the register file. And we can do something similar for a conditional jump. Use it as part of the input to the mux in front of the PC register that decides whether we take the value from the instruction or the PC plus the length of a jump. Yes?
Can you show those other inputs to that mux are?
So what are the other inputs to this mux? So so this corresponds to jump, for example, or RR move queue. And if you remember, this is encoded with an I code, which I forget, but followed by a zero for the unconditional version. And then we have something which corresponds to C move LE or JLE. And this corresponds with the same I code followed by a one in the encoding. And we have less than, which corresponds to that, followed by a two, and so on. And so there's an option for each of the possible things we could find in the instruction. So the mux is given, like you said, a code for the instruction we're executing. Yeah, and based on that, it chooses the appropriate true or false value computed from the condition codes. Yes?
And then, so then why again do we send it, that result in the NUT
gate? Because we want to choose, this is the, if we choose zero here, this is the one. The way I told you muxes work.
Yeah.
That's why. It's just to fix that up. We could reverse the condition and deal with it that way, or reorder the wires in the mux. But we're going to do some sort of fix up. It turns out we're actually not going to do that because the software we'll use to construct these muxes will be a little more automated than that. Any other questions? Okay. And so the most straightforward thing to do when adding our wiring to implement execute is you just say, well, usually we're adding two values from registers. That's what the standard add instruction does. And this handles the most obvious case, but just like how we needed to add our stack pointer here, we have some other special cases. And the way you should think about this, again, is you should enumerate what do I want to add or subtract or whatever for each of these instructions. And you can think that there are some exceptions. So it's not always register values. So for example, our memory move instructions, we need to add a displacement plus the value of a register. So we need some way of getting that displacement is not one of the register values. And it comes from the instruction. So we need a mux, which lets us choose to use the placement sometimes and the register value others. We also have a bunch of instructions where we need to add or subtract a constant. When we're computing new values for the stack pointer, either to push or pop, we add or subtract 8, because that's the amount we push or pop from the stack. So all those instructions need to somehow get the constant 8 to the ALU. And so that's going to be another option on some mux in front of the ALU. So our textbook calls the signals we compute as the inputs ALUA and ALUB. And so sometimes they're equal to VALA and VALB, that's the outputs of the register file. Sometimes they're not. So one way you could imagine doing this is something like this. I have a mux which lets us choose the displacement or a register value or 8. And we also have some logic I'm not showing you, which chooses whether we do an add or subtract. Yes? Those are the two inputs to the ALU, which I'm using the names the textbook uses for them. So the ALU conceptually does A something B equals Z. Yes?
For the condition jumps, are you using the condition code created from the previous step construction from the ALU generated?
For the conditional jumps, do the condition codes the jump uses come from the ALU? Yes. So they're set by the ALU in some prior instruction, whatever the last addition, subtraction, XOR, and instruction was. Set them, and we read them, even though we're actually going to end up using the condition codes for a conditional jump over here, and the conditional codes for a conditional move over here. When our textbook writes down the instruction descriptions, they sort of act like we read the condition codes in the execute step. And there will be a good reason why they do it there, even though that's not where we use the result of reading them, when we talk about our next stage of processor design after the exam. Okay. So this is up to the execute step. And the next stage our textbook has is memory. So this is straightforward. Basically, everything that uses this data memory happens in this step. So you just need to worry about what, you know, we need to have a name for the value that comes out of the memory, which the textbook calls valM. And we also need to figure out what's the address we read, what's the value we write if we write a value, and of course, whether we're reading or writing. So the most straightforward thing is that in the common case, the address for writing is computed by the ALU. We add a displacement in the register, or we add the stack pointer in something. That's the common case for the address we're reading or writing. And when we're writing a value, it usually comes from a register. So that's the common case. But just like with the ALU input, the common case isn't the only case we have to worry about. We have some instructions which are exceptions. And the way you figure this out is you write down what's the input for each instruction to the address, to the data, and does it actually match how I just wired things up, or do I need to add a mux and make a choice? And if you do this, and you do this carefully for each instruction, you'll find out that there's some tricky cases. And this is probably the most confusing of these cases where we need a mux. And this is for pop and return. So these both pop something from the stack. So on a pop instruction, what we do, so what you might like write it down as is that pop into RAX, you might say it reads from memory at RSP into RAX, and then it increments the stack pointer. So in this case, this is going to be the ALU output. And that's not the value where we want to read. So we need to do something about that. So how about push? What does push RAX do? What are the steps? Yeah. Yeah, so the way you usually write down the steps of this is you say it decrements the stack pointer and then sets the value there to RAX. And that's a fine description for humans of what the instruction does, but remember that we do everything in one cycle. So we're going to do these two thing writes are going to happen at the same time, which means that the value we're reading to figure out where we're writing is going to come is not going to see this write. So in fact, we're going to need to do something like this, because these two happen at the same time. They don't happen in any particular order. So we're going to actually write to RSP minus 8. And that means that here, that this is going to be the ALU output. So this is same time. So we actually do want the ALU output there. And basically choosing between using the output that we're about to write to the RSP or the original value of RSP is how we decide what order the stack pointer changing and changing the value in memory seems to happen in. Even though in reality, they're both going to occur at the same time at the rising edge of the clock when the register file acts and the memory acts to actually update the stored values. So we also have to worry about the value to write. So here, the value we're writing is a register, is RAX. For call and return, for call, what value are we writing? What value? So call is very similar to push, but it writes a different value. What's that value? Yeah. Yeah, so the call instruction is writing the address that we want to return to. And that address isn't in our register file. So it needs to get its input from elsewhere. So for call, the value we are, so call here, this is gonna writes PC plus, and it happens to be 10, that's the length of a call instruction, which doesn't come from our register file, so we're going to have a mux that's going to choose whether to get the next PC or not. And I actually drew this wrong. So I will fix this. This goes, so we get dirt. So that's the logic we end up having. So that for call, we have this extra case. For call, we need to get this PC plus something. Otherwise, we get a register value. And we also need to choose between taking the value we just read from the register file or that value with something added or subtracted from it. Any questions on anything on this picture? Okay, so then we have the second to last step in our textbook, which is write back. This is where we actually write registers. And so the things that when we're designing a processor we need to worry about are these two register number inputs and these two register value inputs. And this is where you can figure out why they have the funny names they do. So one of them is named with a capital M because it's the one which was going to correspond to when we write a value that comes from memory. And one has a capital E, which corresponds when we write a value which comes from the ALU, which is in the execute step. That's why our book chose those names. And sort of that's the default wiring. And we can again look at whether this really handles all cases. And the big issue here, big glaring issue, is that if I just say we write to RA or RB, that's not going to work because, for example, some instructions don't write to a register. So we better have some extra logic there to make that happen. So we're going to have some logic for DEST D and something similar for DEST M where we can choose to write to nothing, which is represented by passing the register number 15. And we also have some cases where we need to, from some input, write to RSP. The reason we need to write to RSP is because we're updating the stack pointer. And that stack pointer is not any of the registers in the push and pop and call and return instructions that, that are anywhere in the instruction, at least guaranteed. Maybe they're there in the address, but can't count on that. So we need some place to pass the register number for RSP. So then we're going to end up with something like this, and if we something like this for the logic to choose the register number, and we also need to choose the value to write. And usually, the value we're writing is going to be the value from a register. Is going to be the result of a calculation. Sometimes it's the value from a register. So there's both cases. And the most straightforward thing to do would be to add a mux to handle that. This is for the E input, and for the other input, the value we're writing comes from memory. So that's another case you need to handle. I could have sent these most of the time both to E and put a mux in front of that, and then I just need to figure out the case where I need to write two registers, but I've done the thing where I have the least extra muxes. Okay. So there's other ways of doing this. But I just chose one way which can handle all the instructions because I looked at what pop does, which is the one which needs to write two registers, and this can handle that. And I decided that I'll do all memory writes with the M port and all the other writes with the E port. But I could have done something else, like I could have decided sometimes I use the M port for some ALU operation writes, sometimes I don't. So our textbook doesn't actually do this logic with a mux, they do something else. Anyone read the textbook carefully and figure out what that is? They made a different choice, which is equally valid, but looks kind of weird. So here, we're deciding, sometimes I want to do R move Q, sometimes I want to do like an add. Our textbook has a different way of handling things like R move Q. There also might be something else that we would handle in this way that textbook handles differently. So what the textbook does is they say, hey, I don't want to have this extra mux here. So instead, I'm going to have a way of specifying 0 in the ALU. And I'm just going to do a useless addition. This is also how they deal with IR move Q, which you could also deal with that mux there. So this is what our textbook chooses to do. It's kind of a weird trick. You don't have to do it. We won't have you do it if you don't want to. But you can see it's equivalent. We just always use the ALU rather than only sometimes using the ALU to decide what value to write to that register port. So any questions on what's on this picture? So then we have our last stage. So we have all the components, but the last and pretty important stage, which is to update the PC. And this is straightforward. We need to choose what's the next instruction we're running, which is the input to the PC register. And our common case is what we've called valp, which is PC plus the instruction length, which remember, in our textbook's design, is computed in the fetch stage. But we have some exceptions. We have call and conditional jumps, where we take something that's in the instruction and send that to the PC. And we have return. So for return, where does the next address to run come from? So it's based on the stack pointer. Yes. So it comes by taking the stack pointer, putting it into the data memory, and getting the address out. So we have three cases we need to handle. We have valp, we have a constant from the instruction, and we have the value we got from the data memory. And I will draw over this error. That is not readable, but this should come, this wire, six, this should come from, this should be valp here. instead of that when it's there. And so this is our complete, does almost everything except you didn't add this back in, processor diagram. And we're not going to have you like memorize this. What I hope you figured out is that, yeah, you could just look at what the textbook has written down, its full diagram with all its things which decide inputs. But really, you should be able to figure out, how do I choose the inputs for each step? That's what we want you to learn, because that's the more useful skill, because if you wanted to actually figure out how processors work, it's not always going to be YD6. You're not always going to have quite the same components we have. You might have a different number of ports in your register file or something like that. You should still know how to make that work. So I've shown you sort of pictures of what our processor hardware looks like. And that's a perfectly reasonable way of describing hardware for showing it to people. It's pretty easy to understand. But if you like actually wanted to build a processor, you probably wouldn't be happy, if you're responsible for manufacturing it, just receiving a picture on a big piece of paper. This is not what we actually do in industry. It is something you can do, and there are even commercial tools where you design a processor or something similar by drawing pictures on a computer program, basically, where you connect wires, sort of like what I'm showing you, and this is something which you can then be turned into a physical processor. So this is something which exists, but it is not very commonly used for making real processors, because it's kind of awkward to deal with drawing pictures when you have, something as complicated as a processor. So instead, we have sort of specialized programming languages for hardware, which look like a normal programming language. They have things that look like variables and assignments and operators. And you write text programs typically that represent some circuit with these components like registers, register files, memories. And often these have abstractions, just like you use in your own programming languages, so you can, not have to worry about the details of how do I construct an add. I just want an adder here. Let's deal with that in some other step. How do I build registers? I just want a register here. Someone else should figure out how to actually build that. So there's these abstractions, so you can use these higher level components we talked about without having to worry about how they get built from transistors while you're designing your processor. And the tools can handle converting these abstractions into something that we can actually build a processor from. So we're not going to talk about the details of how you implement one of these tools to make these abstractions work, but we're going to be using a tool like this to actually build a processor. And this is similar to what our textbook called HCL, which is their language. So we're going to be using a tool that this semester is called HCLRS. If you've talked to people who've taken this course before, this is just a re-implementation of HCL to D, which is what we used in previous semesters, and a re-implementation that should have essentially the same syntax everywhere. But maybe better error messages, I hope, if I succeeded. So this tool is kind of similar to the real commercial tools that would be used, but substantially simplified. The biggest simplification is this tool sort of embeds the assumption you're making a processor like you're making for this course. So the abstractions we give you sort of have hardwired components of the ones you'll need for a processor, rather than being generic like you'd want a real commercial tool to use, because hey, you're not always making a YD6 processor of this design. And of course, other things are just simpler than you deal with in a commercial tool, where you might need to worry at some points about how does this actually get turned into hardware. We're going to not have you deal with that pretty much at all. But in a real tool of this sort, sometimes you'd have to go below the abstractions to make things work. We're just going to deal with high-level abstractions where like you have math operators, and you never, ever worry about how they work. That might not happen in the real world. So let's go through what a program in this language for to implement a processor would look like. So I'm going to implement this CPU. This is a NOP CPU, so it assumes all our instructions are NOP. Since all our instructions are NOP, I don't even need to look at the output of the instruction memory. It's a NOP, I don't need to check. And I just add one, that's the length of a NOP, and that's all I do. So let's look at what this is going to look like in HCLRS. So the first thing we're going to need is we need to specify the PC here, that register. So in HCLRS, there's a way you can declare as many registers as you like. And the syntax is going to look like this. So we say, we declare what is called a register bank. So you declare more than one. In this case, I only have one. And the bank has a name with two letters. In this case, I've chosen a lowercase p and a capital F. The general rule is the first letter is always lowercase. The second letter is always uppercase. And I specified this 64 here. The 64 means that this register is 64 bits wide. I can specify any bit width that is less than 128 that I want. And I also specified equals zero here. This means that when our processor first starts, that's going to be the value in the register. After a processor starts, it's going to act like the registers we discussed. It's going to read its input and copy it to its output after every clock cycle. So since we have an input and an output, we need to know what are those named? How do I refer to the input and output? How do I say anything about what they are? How do I specify these connections here? So the input and output have names which are based on these two letters. So the first letter is the name of our input signal. So our input signal is going to be named starting with a lowercase p and an underscore for every register I've declared here. And the output signal is going to be named with a capital F. Underscore. And so to indicate this little circle here, I say I take the output signal, which is capital F underscore the PC, and I say I want to add one to it. And as an abstraction, we just let you say plus one, and we'll figure out what that would turn into in gates. You don't have to worry about doing that. And then we assign that to the input signal, which is lowercase p underscore the PC. Yes?
The CPU is obviously just hardware, right? And so how does it understand these like declarations of like this is the name of the register, this is the size of the register, this is what the starting value, how does it know like what PF and VPC 64, how does it know what all that means? Like,
so the question is, how does this get turned into hardware?
Yeah.
So what's gonna happen in a commercial version of this tool, a tool like this, is that they'll take this description and they'll make a description of the hardware components you need to build. And they'll give you something that you can send to a hardware manufacturer and they'll know how to arrange transistors on a piece of silicon to make that happen.
So
basically, it will compile into a description of physical hardware.
Okay.
Is the idea. Our tool doesn't actually support that step, but the idea is that this is something which would let us write something which compiles into a description of physical hardware. And there's a bunch of work that needs to happen to make that work, because we need like a description of a register and the wiring, and we need to decide where exactly that is physically. That's not going to be something we're going to discuss how to do in this course, but that's actually it's kind of like a whole class worth of material easily, about how you would take this description and turn it into a good hardware description. But this is something where there are widely existing tools that can do that. Okay. So that takes care of our adding one to PC part. So the other thing I have pictured here is I have an instruction memory that we read from. And in the tool we're going to have you use, the instruction memory is a built-in component that exist without you just declaring anything. It's just always there because it's designed for building processors for this course. And the input and output wire to the instruction memory have particular names. So the input wire is called PC. I'm sorry that that conflicts with the register name. This is to be consistent with the textbook. And the output wire is called I10 bytes. The 10 bytes is because it's going to read 10 bytes every time to handle the largest instruction we need to deal with. That's just hard-coded into our tool. And as this slide says, this is mandatory. You must supply an input for this, or else our tool will say, sorry, I have this instruction memory I'm requiring you to use. Okay. So there's one other mandatory component in this tool, and that's going to be the status register. So this is a built-in component, a built-in thing which kind of looks like a register, and the input signal is named stat with a capital S. And this is how we specify when this is running, whether it stops or not. So we'll have a simulator for your processor, and we need to know when does the simulation stop. And the way you tell whether or not it stops is by supplying an input to this special register. So there's two constants that you'll use most often. So one is stat underscore AOK. And if you supply this constant, this says, keep going. I still have work to do. The other one is stat underscore HLT. And that means stop. If you don't supply that a status which says to stop, it's going to keep simulating when you run this. So speaking of running this, let's do an actual demo and see how that goes. So if you download HCLRS, you'll get something like this, but without some of the .hcl files, which I wrote for this lecture. And there's a makefile. You've probably seen this before. You want to type make to build the tool that we have. And then we can take our we can have our CPU as a source file. So I have a file called nopcpu.hcl, which contains exactly what you saw on that slide. So I need to run this. So the tool to run it is called .hclrs. And if I do nopcpu.hcl, I say, wait a moment, it complains. It gives me the useless message, and this is because I need to supply a yo file, whatever that is. So the instruction memory, as I said, is a mandatory component, and you need to supply an image of for the instruction memory. You need to supply contents for memory. That is not optional. It doesn't assume anything, so you need to say what's the initial value of memory. So we need some program to run. And if you want to have a program to run, you can write it in assembly. In particular, YAD6 assembly. So I have here So let's write a assembly program. I didn't include the right files. So I have here here's an assembly program for YAD6. Okay. Nop, 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 nop. Simple program, and we want to convert it to our equivalent of an executable file, which is going to have the extension .yo. So it's basically the YAD6 object file equivalent. And I can do that with make. So then I can type make, so I have nops.ys, so I've replaced .ys with .yo. I'm sorry. And it runs a tool called YAS, which is YAD6 assembler. And the .yo file is the contents of memory. And in fact, to help you debug and things like that, the contents of that file are actually readable in a text editor. So in here, we have an address in memory and the bytes that are at that address in hexadecimal. And we have, after this pipe character, the assembly that produced that. So our simulator is going to read this file, and it's going to read everything before the pipe characters to load the initial values of the instruction memory. So now that I have this file, I can run it on my simulator. So I can do htlrs nopcpu.hcl and nops.io as the input file. So I just run that, and it does a lot of stuff. Let's make this fit a little better. Okay, so it seems to be spending a lot of time. And it says timed out after some number of cycles. So why didn't it stop? Because we told, if we look at our HCL, we said stat is A-OK, keep going. So it always kept going, and it ran until it timed out. By default, we time out after 10,000 cycles. And if you look at the output we have here, we have the values of the register file that are conveniently output. So that's another one of our built-in components, is the register file. We also have the value of the register, the PC I declare, in hexadecimal. That's why it's not 10,000. We're close to it. So it's hexadecimal. And also the contents of memory. When the contents of memory is printed out, things which were initially zero just aren't output. So this says memory at address 0000x0 is 10, 0000x1 is 10. That's 10 in hexadecimal, which is, if you remember, the encoding of NOP. Yes?
So after, like, there were only 5 NOPs in there, so after 5 cycles, what was the PC output?
So that's conveniently in this output here. So we read, so we passed to the instruction memory, PC of, right, you can't see that highlight. And I probably should not try to do this. So we passed to the instruction memory a PC of hex 270F, and we read an instruction, the halt instruction, because there were zeros there. So the contents of memory, where you don't set it with a .yo file, are just all zeros. So we read something, it just was a halt instruction, but our processor we wrote doesn't know that. It never checks. So it just kept going. Yes?
Can you make it run like only 5 times instead of 1,000?
So could we make it run only 5 times instead of 1,000? Yes. So we will talk about fixing our problem here. So let's say we want to have the halt instruction actually halt. So basically what we want to do there is have a mux which decides sometimes I'm going to say keep going, sometimes I'm going to say halt, sometimes I might say something else. And we're going to do that based on the opcode. So there's going to be some way of writing that in our hardware programming language. And the way we're going to do that is with a mux. And the way we're going to represent mux in HTLRS is with this, what syntax our book calls a case expression, which is one of the subjects of a pre-quiz. So what this does is we say some result wire, so like stat would be a result output, is whichever one of these matches first. So if x equals 5, we output 1. Then if x is not 5, we check the next thing. If x is 0 or 6, we output 2, and so on. So we check all these as if in order, and that's the output. And this is how we're going to represent a mux. So you note that unlike the muxes I showed you sort of in hardware, I don't have to worry about computing that select input. I just write whatever funny expressions I want, and the tool will figure it out. And this is true of commercial tools. Commercial tools, this is actually something that's, you can write an algorithm to compute efficient hardware to figure out how to choose the appropriate input based on expressions like this. And so we're assuming that that would be given to you. This is how we represent a MUX, which chooses between 1, 2, 3, and 4, which are, would be different inputs to the MUX based on some conditions which have to do with some value x. And note that we have this last case here where I just put a 1, just like in C, 1 is true. And that's the default because it's evaluated in order. So if nothing else matches, there's going to be 4 as the output. Any questions on what this syntax means? Yes?
The book sentence, those don't have to be exclusive. Is that just because it's using the first one?
Yes, so the book says they don't have to be exclusive, so it's using the first one. So for example, if I supply 5 here, 5 matches x equals 5 and x is greater than 2. The output is going to be 1 because that's the first thing which matches.
Okay, so this is non-exclusive. Like, there will always be just 1 and it will always be the same.
Yeah, there will always be one output. It's always the first thing which matches. This is happens to make some things more convenient, and it's not actually much harder for the tools which are going to convert this into a physical circuit. Okay, so this is the syntax we're going to use to represent a MUX every time we need one. So all those MUXes I added to the processor, we showed it earlier, you're just going to write an expression like this that says what to do. And probably instead of x, you're going to deal with some I code which you got from somewhere, hopefully the instruction memory. So let's think about that in this case. So we need to extract the I code, use it to in one of those case expressions. So how do we extract the opcode? And if you remember when I talked about earlier, that this value here has a name of i10bytes. And as you might guess by the name, it's a 10-byte value. And we just want the opcode part. So in hardware, what this would be is we'd have a whole bunch of wires, and we take 4 of them, and this would be the opcode, and we just not use the others. And we're going to have a convenient way of representing this in our hardware description language. So unlike C, where you have to deal with values and registers, and you need these bitwise operators, we're going to have an actual first-class way of doing this, because in physical hardware, this is an easy operation that you want to do a lot of the time. And the syntax is going to look something like this. If I want to get bits 2 through 9 of a bundle of wires that holds a larger value, I can just treat it kind of like an array. So this means that we have to have numbers for our bits. And this is a point of a lot of confusion in this class. So since we have numbers for our bits, it matters what number we give to what bit. And in HTLRS, the least significant bit is the one we're going to give the number 0. And we're going to go, the next least significant is 1, and so on. And why this gets confusing is because people don't think intuitively about how this interacts with memory addresses and values, which is going to matter because we have a 10-byte value which comes from memory, and I've numbered the bits of it. And our 10-byte value is an integer that is interpreted in little endian order, because that's what we're always going to use in this class. It's always a little endian. So the first byte of the value is the least significant byte. So given that, if we know what our nop instruction looks like, we have a 1, 0, and we want to extract this 1, how am I going to do that? What bits is that 1 from? Yeah.
Can you do a shift?
So a shift, what we do in C, where we have to work with registers. So we're going to ultimately use this syntax. where we say, I want bits X through Y. We have this directly, we don't even need shifts, and we can get actual, say we want a 4-bit value, so unlike when you're programming, in programming you can use 64 or 32 bits, you can't, don't have many other options here, we can have a 4 or 5 or 6 or 7-bit value. That makes sense in hardware, because if I want a 7-bit value, I just have 7 wires that hold bits. That's not such a good option when you're programming on a processor where you have 32-bit registers, and you can't make them 7-bit registers. So what are the values I'm going to use for i10 bytes of something dot dot something? Yeah?
Just do 1 to 1.
1, 2, so these are bit numbers.
Wait, is that bit 0?
So bit 0 is the least significant bit. So the first question is, this is how I wrote my instruction encoding here. Where is bit 0 in here? So you really attempted to say, hey, it's the first thing as I'm reading, it must be where the 1 is, and that is not correct, because it's the least significant bit is bit 0. And when we have a value 1, 0, the 1 is the most significant part of that. Yeah, and this gets people constantly, which is why I'm spending time on it. So, for example, let's say we have a push. This is how a push is encoded. We have the first byte is AF. The second byte is 2F. If we lay this out as a 2-byte little endian number, the F here is the part, is where the least significant bit is, and the 4 least significant bits, followed by the A, which is the opcode, followed by the F of the second byte, followed by the 2. This is because when we're writing out in our encoding what the instructions are, we're writing out each byte separately, and we write each byte like we would in English, and in English we typically write numbers with the least significant part last. So the bits we want to extract are these bits. And if this is 0, that's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, and 8. So the bits we want are actually going to be i10 bytes of 4 to 8. The bit range is included to not included. The way you can think about that is that if I have a 64 value when everything is 0, dot, dot, 64. So people look confused on this. So the non-intuitive part is that you should think of the values we have written down as a list of byte values, which when we make it a number, we put them in little endian order, which means the first thing goes at the end if we're writing in English. Or the first thing is where the 0 part is, but the 0 part is the least significant part. So, questions?
So, in this case, why do we want the i10 bytes of 4 through 8 together?
So, that would be how we extract the value A here. And if you want to know that this is a push instruction, that's where you need to look. And for the example we started with, you want to know whether it's a NOP or HALT, that's where you need to look. Yes?
So, is the initial memory address in big endian, and then like switching around is just how it's converted to little endian?
So the question is the initial memory address in big endian? So no. So if we have just a 64-bit value, and I never let you extract bits or bytes from it, you can never know what endianness it has. So like, so far, the value in RPC register can't tell what endianness it has, because there's, if I can't name bits or bytes, who knows what order it's in. As for the values we're storing, this is just sort of an artifact of how this table is written. So the table here that you've seen before, we've labeled each byte. Yeah, so there's no question on order, really, because we said this is byte 0, this is byte 1. And normally it doesn't matter, so I've just written out the byte values in the natural way. And if we didn't have a way of addressing individual bits, you'd have no way of knowing the order. You have no way of knowing that they're numbered in a non-intuitive way, right? If you could only address bytes, this actually works very intuitively. The problem is we can address bits, and we need to choose an order for the bits to be addressed in. And it seems like maybe it would help if I numbered the bits so that they go in so that I could write 0, 1, 2, 3, 4 all the way across this picture. But if I did that, then bit 0 would be the eighth least significant bit. And bit 8 would be, seventh least significant bit, and so on, and then bit 8 would be the eighth least significant bit. And that would end up probably being more confusing than sort of fixing this, changing the, how we numbered the bits to not do that. Yes?
So this table is just for us to understand?
So this table is for writing down the bytes.
And then the way that it's written is?
But when we read the bytes, we're going to take something like this. We're going to take the first byte and treat that as the bottom of a number. Then the next byte goes above it in little endian order.
Gotcha.
So this just tells you what the bytes are. When you actually construct numbers from these bytes, which is what we do when we read memory, we take the first part goes in the least significant piece of the number, the next part goes in the next least significant piece, and so on. Which, if you write it down like you would in English, is not the order it's written in this table. But this table is probably the most natural way of writing it if you want to actually encode or decode instructions. Mainly because the instructions have different lengths. When I say first byte, I'm going to mean the one with the lowest address.
So on the right side.
So on this picture.
Not on this.
Yeah. So as far as little endian, the first byte goes in the least significant part, which is rightmost when we're writing it down as an English number. Yes.
So you just flip this and it's okay.
You flip it byte by byte, and that's what the. And then you can number go 0, 1, 2, write 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, and so on, and it will correspond to the bit numbering that HCL is using. Okay, so this point of confusion will come up later, I'm sure. I'm mentioning it now because as a early warning. You'll figure it out once, basically, and do it, but it's a big point of confusion. So we figured out that it's 4 through 8 is where we get the opcode. And our tool has predefined constants for the instruction I-codes, so you don't need to like look them up or figure out what they are, though you could do that. I could write 1 instead of nop and 0 instead of halt, but there's constants for that. But I have my mux here, where I say, hey, if the opcode is equal to nop, then the stat should be A-OK, otherwise it should be halt, and send that to this stat signal. And if I have my HCL file that implements that, and then run it on program, it actually stops. Okay. And we can also do something similar to add other instructions. So if I want to add unconditional jumps, you know, this is the picture I had earlier. And what I actually need to add is I first need to extract this destination signal. And that's going to be a set of bits of the instruction. And I've done a trick here, which is handy, which is that, hey, they're variables, kind of variables. So I can declare something called a wire, and that gives me a name for something like dest or the iCode, so I don't need to keep writing it over and over and over again. And when I declare that, I also say iCode is 4 bits wide, dest is 64 bits wide. And just like before, I can have some assembly file, and I can compile that assembly file into the corresponding .io file, and the assembler figures out what all the instructions are, including the addresses to jump to, and I can run, and I can have a copy of that CPU here, and just run it. And spell my file names correctly. And you see we got what happens in each cycle. If I scroll up, you can see it loads the jump instruction and goes in the order we expect. At least I hope. Okay. So that's a demo of sort of basic capabilities. So our MUXes, we can make our decisions, and we do this for everything, and eventually we implement all the instructions. So I haven't told you about some important things like it displays lots of register values, and I haven't told you how to set or read those, but we have a built-in register file that there's some way of accessing. There's obviously a way of accessing the data memory, otherwise how do we implement MRMoveQ? And I'll show you that in a bit. But first, let's talk about differences from the book. So our book describes a language called HCL, which the textbook authors made. Ours is a bit more flexible and has some minor, hopefully useful syntax differences. So one difference is that when we declare those shortcut variable-like things, we use the name wire and not bool or int. So we just call them all wires. You don't have to worry about whether they're one bit or not. You just declare them with the number of bits they are. The book has these names like valc, and in the book's author's tool, you have to use some of those names. Except for our built-in components, which is going to be the register file and memories, you don't have to use the names we choose. You can use whatever names you find convenient. So if you think valc is a horrible name, you can call it like call address. That is fine. Also, we don't have a built-in ALU, so you're going to need to implement that yourself with muxes and addition, subtraction, which are operators in our HCL. So I mentioned that we have some built-in components, like those registers I displayed, and there's some way of setting them. And the way all these components work is that there's some built-in wires, which are those signal names you can assign to or read from, like PC was one, and I10 bytes was another, corresponding to the instruction memory, and we have some various other components which have those. And we saw that also for register banks. So register banks, you could declare one, and it created two signals, one to read the output of the register and one to set the input. And that's true in general. Register banks, more generally, you have the input name and the output name. You can define multiple of these, and they'll be act independently of each other. Later on in the course, we'll have a reason we want to do that. But for now, the only register you probably need to define is for the program counter. You can define multiple of these registers. You just separate them with semicolons, different default values, and they all have the same prefix and postfix for the signals. the initial value is mandatory, we have to know what the register start as. And there's some other signals that are in our HTLRS documentation that I'll talk about after the exam. So we also have wires, and wires kind of look like just variables. And you can mostly think of them like that, but they act a little differently in general. So they're things which can accept or produce a signal. So if a wire doesn't have a value yet, you can assign a value to it, and you can use a wire's value in multiple places. You can think of this like connecting something to a wire to assign a signal, and connecting a wire to something when you're using a wire's value. And some of these wires are built in. So all the built-in signals act like wires you could have defined and assigned things to. So one caveat with wires, which makes them act not like variables, is that order doesn't matter. So here, these two pieces of code are equivalent. Our tool is just going to look at all the assignments, and it's going to figure out an order to run them in. That works. You can think of it as making physical connections. A wire is either connected to something or it isn't. It doesn't matter. There's not an order in which the connections happen. It's just connected or not. And that's how you should think about when you're writing these wire declarations. So you can do it in any order, and our tool's going to figure out how to make that work. If you try to assign multiple values to a wire, that's an error. If you try to use a wire's value without having a value assigned to it, that's an error. If you try to have a loop where a wire's value depends on itself, that's an error. Wires also have widths. So I've shown you these widths. We say it's 64 bits wide or it's 4 bits wide. You are not allowed to assign values of different widths to each other. You need to do something like use the take a subset of the bits operator. And this like makes sense physically. If you had a bundle of 16 wires and a bundle of 8 wires and I tell you to connect them, you're going to say no. And our tool is going to say the same thing. Okay. So that's how wires work. Any questions about anything about wires? Yes. Could we make the top two wires equal to each other? Absolutely. Yes. Okay. So let's talk about some of the built-in components. So I mentioned, showed you the stat register, and I said this is how we know another continue. So I talked about AOK and HLT. There's some other status values that you might use. One important one is INS for invalid instruction. As far as you're concerned, the difference is that this makes our simulator exit with a different message. Otherwise, it's the same as halt. And you must set the stat value to something. You need to tell it whether or not we keep going, or else it will just say, I can't run your program. So we talked about the instruction memory. So we have this input wire, the PC, which says is the 64-bit address to read, and the output wire, i10 bytes. It's 10 bytes because that's the width of the largest instruction you have to deal with. And we just hard-coded that into our simulator. And that's okay. You just don't use the extra bits when you're executing other instructions that aren't 10 bytes long. We also have a register file. And the register file has wires corresponding to all the things I've drawn on the picture that are inputs and outputs. They have maybe slightly different names. This is in the HTRLS write-up that you can read, so you don't need to memorize these. You can look them up when you need them. So we have four register number inputs, two sources, and two destinations. And these are 4 bits wide because that's how big our register numbers are. And if you don't want to write a read, you supply the register number 15, which there's a built-in constant for, reg_none. You can just write in the code rather than hard coding 15 and forgetting why it's 15. There are two register value inputs. They're called input E and input M. reg_input_e, reg_input_m. These are 64-bit wide because that's how big our registers are. And there are two outputs, output A and output B. So these two outputs, A corresponds to source A, B corresponds to source B, input E corresponds to dest E, input M corresponds to dest M, like you would hopefully expect. So let's implement something we saw before, which was our add CPU in HCL. And this would use the register file. So we'd extract RA and RB. And yes, these are the bits they're in. And we would set them as our source and source registers. We'd set our destination register and our destination value. And that's how you'd implement that add CPU I showed you before. So it's all just setting these inputs and outputs to the register file based on what we read from the instruction. Any questions on this? Okay. So this is sort of pictorial mapping of what I showed you to the register file. I'd note that for convenience, I didn't set all the values of these inputs. So for example here, I didn't set destm. That's okay. If you don't set destm, it's going to default to none for you. That's just for convenience. And it's going to be fine for you not to set input m if you don't set destm as a special case, just for convenience. Generally, we'll give you a warning if you set input m without setting destm, hopefully. So, but you can omit, you can not read and write from certain sources. You can just not write them in your program. And for convenience, our tool will just hardwire that to do nothing, rather than requiring you to specify that, hey, destm is nothing explicitly. We'll just assume that's what you mean if you don't write anything about it. Okay, so that's our register file. We also have one more built-in component, which is the data memory. So we have the instruction memory, which lets us read values, and we could conceptually use it when we need to read from memory, but we also need to write to memory, so we need something which lets us do that. And we actually want to read from two places in memory in the same clock cycle, so we need two memories to do that. The data instruction memory, even though they're conceptually separate memories that you access with separate signals, they're going to access the same actual array of bytes. So if you write to the data memory where your instructions are and then read from the instruction memory, you're going to read the value you just wrote. And our data memory, just like our register file, just has named wires corresponding to the wires I drew on pictures earlier. So our input address is named mem_adder, our input value is mem_input, and our output value is mem_output. We also need to decide whether we're reading or writing, and the way we're going to do that is that there's two signals, one's called read bit, one called write bit. If read bit is 0, we don't read. If it's 1, we read. If write bit is 0, we don't write. If it's 1, we write. And if you set them both to 1, don't do that. And just like we described how the memory works, you get the output in the same cycle. So if you're reading, that you'll get the output in the same cycle, just like we discussed. If you're writing, the memory will be updated just before the next cycle. Okay, so any questions on data memory? So one final thing. So our processor simulator has some debugging tools. So there's a dash D option. And if you do that, it tells you all the signals that get sent. You will probably find this very useful when you need to use this tool. There's also a dash I option for interactive. If you use this, it will run in one clock cycle and then ask you to press enter to do the next clock cycle. And you can, of course, combine these two options. So that's all I have. So notes, so Tuesday we'll do review. So come with questions. On the exam, we're not gonna have you write HCL. We'll save that for labs and homeworks. We might describe a circuit using HCL on the exam, but that's all we'll do with it. Describe it with HCL rather than drawing a picture for you.
That's it.